I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Dharma and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, I engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrow and bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger.
So take a moment and contemplate those four measurables. Try and generate a feeling of goodwill, of kindness, of tolerance towards all other living beings, whether you like them or don't like them. And try and have some feeling of kindness, compassion towards them. Face and jaw. relax. If your facial muscles are tight, also let them relax. And then be aware of your entire body again. And how its position is firm, but also at ease, no tension. And aware of your breath, not forcing it, just letting it be. And place your attention either at the upper lip and the nostrils, being aware of the breath, the sensation of the breath as it passes by there. Or be aware at your belly, the rise and fall of your belly as you inhale and exhale. So choose one of the two places, don't go back and forth between them. And simply observe your breath from that vantage point. Being really interested in what is happening with each breath. What happens as you start to inhale, as you're inhaling. End of the inhalation, and what is happening as you start to exhale, as you're exhaling at the end of the exhalation. Is there a pause at any of those places? And if so, what's happening? So this way, you're bringing your mind to what's happening now. You're sitting in a room with like-minded people in a safe place, watching your breath. You can also be aware of the transient and changing nature of your breath. Never stays the same in the second moment. So we'll have some time of silence to do this. About 10 minutes. bigger picture of our being in samsara and how we can be liberated from samsara. One thing that comes through this explanation is we begin to see that an understanding of karma gives us the power to create the causes for the kind of experiences we want to have. That understanding karma frees us from the kind of ignorance that is ignorant about karma. There's two kinds of ignorance. One is ignorance about the ultimate nature. That keeps us revolving in samsara. The second kind of ignorance is ignorance about karma and its effects. And that ignorance leaves us creating the causes of suffering, even though what we want is happiness. So an understanding of karma helps us see what kind of actions we need to do to create the experiences we want to have, to become the kind of people we want to be. And then this knowledge of karma also gets us interested in the afflictions, the mental afflictions that cause the karma. That gets us interested in what ignorance of the ultimate nature is, because that's the root of the afflictions that cause the karma. And that gets us interested in learning how to overcome that ignorance in order to free ourselves from having to take rebirth in this cycle of existence. Okay? So I just went backwards. I'm going to go forwards now. I'm not going to go through all of the, some of you may have heard of the 12 links of dependent arising. I'm not going to go through all of them right now because that's outside of our topic for today. But when we talk about how we take rebirth in samsara and how we are free from samsara, there's three phases, you know. So the first phase is ignorance. And here it's the ignorance of the ultimate nature. We don't really know how we exist. We don't know how phenomena around us exist. Things appear to us to be out there, don't they? Like there's an objective world out there, and there's me here. And then I just am trying to navigate my way through this objective world. And so when we have different experiences, you know, we think that they're out there. So like we were talking yesterday, if somebody insults me, the insult is out there and they made me angry. Yeah. But when we investigate, we see that that's not the case. That this whole process depends on our interpreting the sound waves coming from the other person and our having misconceiving how they exist, projecting things on, misinterpreting, and then feeling offended and getting angry. So the whole process, you know, starts with this ignorance that really not only doesn't know, but actively misunderstands the ultimate nature. And whereas things are dependent on other factors, ignorance sees everything as independent, as having its own nature. So this is a gong from its own side, and this is a clock from its own side, and this is a water bottle. It has the essence of water bottleness in it from its own side. That's the way ignorance sees things. Ignorance also sees ourselves that way, that there's a big me, an independent me here. And then there's you and the rest of the world out there. So it doesn't see that we and the rest of the world are dependent on each other. For example, look at our body. Yeah. Isn't our body dependent on the external world? Where do we get food from? Our body's not some independent entity that's static here. It's something that's changing all the time that depends on causes and conditions. For example, the food that we eat, and the genetic material that came from our parents. So things exist dependent on other things, but our ignorance sees things as independent, as having its own nature. And so that ignorant view inflates the importance of the self. So we feel like there's a me here, yeah, and I've got to defend myself from the rest of the world. Yeah. Of course, the happiness I want is outside. So I get attached to all these things and try and bring them to myself. But also, the cause of my misery, ignorance says, is also outside. So then I'm always trying to protect myself from things that come from outside, like physical harm, or insult, or criticism. So this makes our mind rather uncomfortable. We're never really relaxed and accepted. We're always kind of looking at, oh, what's nice and how can I get it for myself, because I'm the most important one. And what's kind of unpleasant and not nice that I can either clobber or run away from, so that it doesn't harm me. And so that brings us our daily experience. Remember, you know how I was talking about how we're so moody, we're up and down like yo-yos? I like, I don't like. I can get something I like. Something I don't like. Okay. You know. And so all day long, you know, We're not having some open, relaxed state towards other sentient beings or towards the environment. We're always up and down, up and down, up and down. You know, I want, I don't want. Give me, get it away from me. I like, I don't like. We're totally involved in this world of this and that. And it doesn't give us any internal peace at all. So, due to that, all sorts of destructive emotions arise. We have clinging attachment. Give me that bell. It's not yours, it's mine. It's gonna bring me happiness. Don't you lay your fingers on it. Yeah. When you look at it, you look at the money, you go, that's kind of ridiculous, isn't it, to have that attitude? You may not have that attitude towards the bell, but do you have that attitude towards money? Do you have that attitude towards possessions? Or towards your family members? Yeah. This is mine! You touch it. You know? I want my money. And this is my family member. And it's my car. And it's my job. So So I want to grab it. So we get all sorts of attachment, don't we? And then anything that threatens that, we get angry at. You can't have it. You're a threat. You're going to take it away. And so we get angry. Then people have something that we want, that we think we deserve. And we get jealous. How come they have it and I don't? I deserve it. They don't deserve it. I should have it. Or we get something and we get arrogant. Look at me. This is my bell. Aren't I good? I have this bell and you don't. So I'm superior to you. So it looks stupid when it's bad. I have this money. I have this boyfriend. I have this job. I have good looks. Don't you like my clothes? They're very stylish. So I'm better than you. My hair looks better than you. So we're always involved in comparing ourselves to other people. Yeah, there's all this comparison, all this competition. We get jealous when we think they're better. We get arrogant when we think we're better. Yeah. Then we get resentful of other people. Sometimes we get enraged by what they do. We're so furious that we want to harm them physically. Or we want to hurdle all of our insults. Or we complain. Of course, we don't complain. Other people complain. We're just telling the truth. We don't see ourselves as complaining. We're just informing people. Okay. So all these emotions create actions. They motivate us to act. So we don't just sit and be jealous, but we do things to destroy the other person's happiness and get it for ourselves. Don't we? Who, me? Don't do that. Look again. We get so angry that we can't bear it, you know, and we just say all sorts of horrible things to the people we love the most. We would never say to strangers what we say to the people we care about. True or not true? Yeah. We get so mad at family members, and then we just bleh, all of our negativity on them. Strangers we get a little bit mad at, but you know, it's not a big deal. Family members, boy, we treat them really rotten. And then we wonder why we don't have happy families. So many people come to me, oh, my husband does this, my wife does this, my parents, oh, my children, the neighbor, and the supreme person that Singaporeans really hate, their boss. I hear so many complaints about bosses. My boss doesn't understand me. My boss always expects me to do more than I can. My boss doesn't give me time off when I want it. I sacrifice for my company and my boss, and they don't give me a promotion. Instead, they retrench me, and I'm the best employee they've ever had. They favor my colleagues, and they don't acknowledge me and how wonderful I am. True or not true? How many of you are bosses? Don't you dare to raise your hand. I have much compassion for bosses in Singapore. They get blamed for everything. I know because at the monastery, I'm the leader. And everything that goes wrong, they blame me. So I'll get together with the bosses at lunchtime, and we can all cry together on each other's shoulders. But you see, you know, the ignorance creates these destructive emotions. The destructive emotions motivate actions. Yeah. So some of our actions are virtuous, you know, and those are motivated by constructive emotions, but they're still done under the influence of ignorance. Then the destructive emotions, they motivate negative karma. And so negative actions, we hit people, we swear at them, and so on, okay? And then, like I was saying yesterday, our actions leave an energy trace on our mind stream called a seed of karma. Or if you get into philosophy, we call it a having happened. But I'm not going to get into that right now. Yeah. And then these karmic seeds ripen when external conditions come together for them to ripen. Okay. And there's many ways in which the karmic seeds ripen. Okay. One way they ripen, that usually if it's a full karmic action, it has a beginning, a preparation, it has the action itself, it has the conclusion. So it's a full karmic action, not an action where we've only thought about doing it but we haven't done it. Or not an action where, you know, there was no intention. Okay? So a full action, there's the intention, the action, the conclusion of the action. Then those actions have three results. One of the results can be divided into two. So we're talking about four results. The first result is called the ripening result, or the maturation result. And this refers to the rebirth that we take. Okay. So during our life, we create many actions. Some are virtuous, like when we make offerings, when we help people, when we generate love and compassion. Others are non-virtuous, when we get angry, when we're greedy, when we criticize others or lie to them. So we accumulate many different karmic seeds during our life. And since we've had beginning of those lives, we also have many different karmic seeds put in our mind stream from previous lifetimes as well. At the time we die, dependent on the strength of the karmic seeds, and dependent upon what mental state we're in at the time we die, the mental factors of craving and grasping nourish one of those or several of those seeds so that they begin to mature. Because at the time of death, if we're ordinary beings still under the influence of ignorance, fear arises of death, that we're leaving everything we know, and that who our whole identity is becoming non-existent. Because we're separating from our loved ones, we're separating from our possessions, we're even separating from this body, we're separating from the world around us, and so we get afraid, who am I going to be without these things that I usually use to define who I am? So then we start to crave this life, and when it becomes apparent that we're going to leave it, we start clinging and grasping to have another life in a cyclic existence, to perpetuate this feeling of I, of me. So that craving and clinging acts as fertilizer that nourishes different karmic seeds in our mind. Now, what karmic seeds can it nourish? If we created a very heavy karma, which can either be virtuous or non-virtuous, so there's different factors that make karma heavy. So, for example, if we had a very strong motivation when we did it, if it was an action that we did with respect to certain objects that are heavy objects. So, for example, actions that we do towards our spiritual mentor and towards the three jewels are heavier because of their qualities and the role they play in our life, guiding us to awakening. So if we create virtuous actions with respect to our spiritual mentors and the three jewels, they're weightier, virtuous karma. If we get angry at them or steal things from them, it's heavier, negative karma. Another strong field of our actions are our parents, because of their kindness to us. So if we're kind in return to our parents, it creates heavier, virtuous karma. If we're mean and nasty to them, it creates heavier, non-virtuous karma. Another field of action that creates weightier karma are the poor, the injured, the ill. So people who have different impediments, who are suffering more than other people typically suffer. So again, if we're kind and generous and helpful and respectful towards those people, the karma we create is heavier. If we're rude and obnoxious and condescending to those people, the non-virtuous karma is heavier. Okay? So at the time of death, if there's some karma that is particularly heavy in our mind stream. Because we did it with one of these heavy objects, we had a strong motivation, we did the action repeatedly, we rejoiced after we did it and thought, I want to do it again. So this goes for both virtuous and non-virtuous actions. These are factors that make the karma weighty. then that karma is more likely to ripen at the time of death than some small karma that wasn't very weighty, okay, that wasn't heavy. Yeah. If all the karmas are equal, or there's not a particularly heavy karma, then the karma that ripens is the one that we did more frequently. Yeah. So some action, it may be even a small one, like making offerings in the morning, what I was talking about yesterday, making offerings at your shrine, but you do it every single day. Yeah. So it becomes a strong karma, and that will ripen. So. Or if there's some bad habit that you do repeatedly, you know, even a small one, like little white lies, yeah, that karma that you did repeatedly will ripen. Yeah. So, you know, there's these kind of things that help the karma to ripen, like the heaviness or the frequency with which we did them. Or, you know, if they were created sooner. So, at the time we die, also what we're thinking in our mental state will help influence what kind of karma ripens. So, for example, if somebody dies and they're very angry at the time of death, yeah, they're angry that they're dying, or they're angry at somebody in their life and they've never forgiven that person for the hurt that, you know, that happened between them, or they've never apologized to somebody that they hurt, so they still have a lot of anger and resentment. Yeah, that kind of mental state nourishes a destructive karma to ripen. If somebody dies with a lot of attachment, yeah, their family is in the room, and the family is all crying and saying, "We love you, don't leave us." And that person feels, "I love them too." Here, the love is actually attachment. It's not what we mean by love in Buddhism, it's attachment. "I don't want to leave my family. I can't leave them. They need me. What's going to happen without me? I need them. I don't want to be separated from them ever, ever, ever." But you're dying and you have no choice about the matter. So this kind of attachment, you know, is a non-virtuous mental state, and so much clinging, you know, in the mind, or maybe clinging to your wealth. "Oh, I don't want to separate from my wealth. And if I have to separate it, I want this child to have it. I don't want that child to have it." And so really worrying about your money and your wealth at the time you die. You know, that kind of clinging and attachment, you know, is non-virtuous. It will make a non-virtuous karma ripen. Okay, the seed of some non-virtuous karma will ripen. On the other hand, if at the time of death we think of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, that's why we visualize the Buddha in our daily practice. Whatever visualization, doesn't have to be completely clear. But we develop that habit of visualizing the Buddha. So at the time of death, we think of the Buddha. We take refuge in the Buddha. Yeah. We think, "May I never be separated from the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in any of my lives." We look back at our life. We rejoice at the virtue we created. We attended Dharma talks. We came to a retreat We did a daily practice. We were generous. We kept our precepts well. We practiced fortitude and restrained our anger. Yeah, so we rejoice at our own merit. We rejoice at others' merit. We make prayers, you know, in all my future lives, may I never be separated from a completely qualified Mahayana Guru who will guide me. And may I recognize that teacher and practice well under their instructions. So if we generate these kind of virtuous thoughts at the time of death, you know, our mind is in a completely different mental state than if we're angry or if we're full of clinging attachment. If at the time we die, we reflect on the empty nature of phenomena and of ourselves, and we think that everything exists dependently, so nothing has an inherent essence. That makes the death process so much easier. We're not holding on to things. If we generate love and compassion and bodhicitta at the time we die, and we say, you know, that I dedicate all my merit and may I never be separated from bodhicitta in all my lives. May I always have teachers who teach me how to generate love and compassion and bodhicitta. And from my side, I'm going forth into my next life, you know, with love and compassion and bodhicitta for everybody that I'm going to meet in my next life. In my next life, may I only benefit sentient beings and never harm them. If you die with that kind of thought, yeah, I mean, even talking about it, doesn't it give you a whole different feeling than when I talk about being angry or when I talk about clinging to your relatives? Doesn't it give you just a whole different feeling in your body and in your mind? So we can see, you know, that what intention we have is going to influence what karma ripens. Yeah. And so that's why it's important, you know, to make preparations for our death. Yeah. And not to wait a long time thinking, I'll die later on, I'm too busy today. Yeah. Or I'm young, I can't die now. Only old people die. That's not true. Yeah. So many people write us at the Abbey and ask us to pray for people that have died. We get, you know, requests to pray for babies or toddlers or teenagers, all the people of all sorts of ages who die from all sorts of things. Yeah. So we can't just think, well, you know, I'm angry at people, but I don't want to apologize and mend it now because they hurt me so much. I'll do it later because anyway I'm going to die later. And maybe they'll die before me and then I won't even have to apologize. That's the wrong way to think. So it's very important to check our mind, and if we're holding grudges against somebody, yeah, to try and do a lot of meditation on fortitude, on patience, so that we can release the anger and forgive these people. Because if we don't forgive them while we're alive, why do we think that at 5 minutes before we die, we're going to have a clear mind and forgive them then? Or if there's somebody we need to apologize to, let's apologize now, because we don't know when we're going to die. Okay? And if we clean up our relationships now by apologizing and forgiving, then we go through our life and we're a lot happier and more peaceful and have better relationships now. But what impedes us from apologizing and forgiving? One factor is very bad anger. Another factor is our pride, our arrogance. Why should I apologize to him? He started. Why should I forgive so-and-so? Look at what they did to me. But if we have thoughts like that, who suffers from them? If we're holding a grudge, who suffers? I hate this person. May he get hit by a truck, and after that, may he go to hell. You know, if you think that towards somebody, who's suffering? Is that other person suffering because of your hatred? No. They're, I don't know, walking down Orchard Road and having fun. Yeah. Who's suffering because of your grudge? We're the chief ones who suffer. Yeah. So, if we want to be miserable, if you really want to be miserable, hold a grudge against somebody. If you want to be happy, release your grudge. If you want to be kind to yourself and be happy, stop hating those people. Because your hatred doesn't harm them. Your hatred harms you. Okay. Now I'm going to tell you about my family. Some of you have heard about my family before. I come from a family that holds grudges. Okay. When I was a little kid, you know, this big, the family had some place, you know, some property that where everybody went to for summer vacation. And there were like four flats on the property. And I was told as a little girl, this kid, don't talk to the people who live upstairs in that flat. Why not? Aren't they our cousins? Aren't they our relatives? Yes, but don't talk to them. Why? Don't talk to them. Do you see why as a child I thought adults didn't make sense? Years later, I found out that the reason I wasn't supposed to talk to their children or play with their children was because at the level of my grandmother's generation, two generations ahead of me, something happened between the siblings. I don't know, there were maybe five brothers and sisters. They had some kind of fight. I don't even know what it was. It happened before I was born. But because of that, I wasn't supposed to talk to the children of the children of the people. Then, time went by. My parents' generation. Yeah. So there were four siblings in my parents' generation. When I was real little, they all spoke to each other. As I got older, they stopped speaking to each other. Yeah. One brother, well, one aunt they didn't like because they didn't like her child. he did something, I don't know what, but they didn't like him, and since she was the mother who defended her child, they didn't like her. Then there was something else that happened with some business and property, I don't know what, but we don't speak to that uncle. Yeah. And so this one doesn't speak to that one doesn't speak to this one, you know. Yeah. Then, more time went by, my generation. Yeah, because we were a whole bunch of cousins. Now the cousins don't speak to each other. And the brothers and sisters amongst the cousins, many of them don't speak to each other. I saw one cousin recently whom I hadn't seen in about 20 years, and she told me how she doesn't speak to her brother because her brother made some comment about their mother that she didn't like. It was a nothing comment, that she doesn't speak to him again. And then this one doesn't speak to that one doesn't speak to this one. Yeah, this one doesn't invite the other ones to family events. And that one didn't invite you to dinner. If they don't invite you to dinner, you don't speak to them again. Yeah, and this one got married for the second time. They didn't invite somebody, probably because it was a small wedding. Don't speak to them again. In my family, when you have a family event, if you're one of the few people who speak to everybody, and you have a family event, making the seating chart is a nightmare because nobody talks to each other. Yeah? And so this kind of grudge holding got passed down from one generation to the next. Each generation was taught to hate their siblings by their parents. Now, of course, the parents, they want all their children to get along. But children learn from watching their parents. And we watched our parents and our grandparents not speak to their brothers and sisters. So that example for the next generation is much stronger than the parents saying, I want all my children to get along. That example of the parent not speaking to their siblings means for the kids, it's fine if you don't speak to each other when you grow up. And then that gets passed down to the next generation. Do you want your kids to hate each other? If you don't, then talk to your siblings. Yeah. And have, you know, you don't have to be super friendly, but talk to them and speak nicely about them. Yeah. If you want your parents, if you want your kids to treat you nice when you're old, don't complain about your parents. Because if you complain about your parents, that's setting the example for your children. They're going to complain about you. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, I saw this. It's my own experience in my family. And in my family, when you vowed never to speak to somebody again, you never broke that vow. Never. People may take wedding vows. You renegotiate those. Yeah. You may take precepts from the Buddha. You renegotiate those. But when you say, I hate you forever, we never change our mind. Isn't that stupid? I mean, we're the chief person who suffers because of when my uncle was dying, his children called my brother, because some of his children were speaking to my brother. I don't know if all of them speak, but, and then my brother mentioned to my mother, and then other cousins mentioned to the aunt, you know, if you want to talk to your brother, you know, who you haven't spoken to in 30, 40, 50 years, now before he dies, this is the time. My mother and my aunt said no. I mean, when I heard that afterwards, it just, it made me feel so awful. Yeah. It's your own brother. He's dying. Why not extend some kindness and compassion? Why not? How does that harm you? But my family doesn't listen to me. So I didn't even say anything. Because it would have made them more angry. Okay? So I advise you, don't have a family like mine. Okay? Do whatever you can do to avoid this happening in your family. Okay? And so sometimes we need to apologize to people. Yeah? We need to humble ourselves and apologize. And we need to forgive people. Apologizing and forgiving, it doesn't need to be a big production. It's mostly a change in our own attitude. And as our attitude changes, then our actions change. And then we can do actions of kindness towards these people that before maybe we ignored. It's really worthwhile if you can do this. And, okay, so I got off on a diversion there. But do you see how if before we die we can forgive and apologize, then we don't have any of that waiting on our mind, troubling our mind when we die. If before we die, you know, you make a will and you give away as many things as you can, not even, I mean, in the will you say who will get it after you die, but even before you die, give things away. Use your possessions to create merit, because your possessions are not going to come with you to the next life. First of all, your relatives aren't going to burn your possessions to send them on. They're going to keep your possessions for themselves. Even if they burn paper money, what good is that going to do you? Do you see any babies coming out of the womb with a fistful of banknotes from the bank of hell, saying, my relatives burn these for me so I would have them in my next life? Yeah. So some baby comes out of the womb, look, they have their fistful of banknotes from hell. Yeah, are they going to be able to go to a store in Singapore and say, I need some food, here's the cash? On. Okay, so much better now, and this is what we've done in the Abbey. We all sat down together. We made out our advanced directives for what we want to happen. You know, if we get sick, if we get incapacitated. We did our power of attorneys, who will have legal power to make decisions for us if we're incapacitated. We made a Dharma will, saying what practices we want done, you know, when we die. And we made a regular will, you know, who's going to get my old chanda? No, actually, yeah. because that merit is going to help you. Whereas having a lot of stuff and you're worried about who's going to get it when you die, that's going to really weigh on your mind. Okay, so make those decisions now. Then when you die, you just go on. Okay, so that's a little bit about how the karma ripens to propel the next rebirth. Okay. So the realm we're born into, until we're able to overcome ignorance, you know, we'll have this ripening of karma fueled by craving and clinging at the time of death. Then, yeah, these full karmas that I talked about, another result they have is after we're reborn, let's say as a human being, the karma influences what will happen to us in our life. Okay? So if, like Nagarjuna said in Precious Garland, generosity is the cause of wealth, ethical conduct is the cause of our rebirth. Okay? So if we keep good ethical conduct, the maturation result will be our rebirth. If we're generous, then we're born with the facilities that we need to stay alive. Okay? So the four requisites we need to stay alive, food, clothing, shelter, medicine. That's the bare necessities. In Singapore, I think everybody here, you have those four. And I think you have much more. You have a hand phone, you have a computer, you have a car. You have lots of stuff. So even more than the four requisites. So this is a result of having been generous in previous life. So use your wealth to create the cause for more wealth and dedicate the merit, not just so that you will be wealthy in your next life, but dedicate the merit so that you and all other beings will attain full awakening. So give to charities, give to Dharma activities, give to people who are needy, who are poor or injured. I read a story in the paper yesterday, but it's the New York Times, so the story didn't happen in Singapore. There was an inmate at one prison, and he was severely beaten up by the guards over something that he didn't do. He had two broken legs and like horrible injuries, and the guards were prosecuted, you know. And so the article, this happened a few years ago, the article had been in the paper. So there was one man who grew up in the community where that prison was located. And he thought, my goodness, you know, here's this inmate. And the inmate had wanted to become a barber, you know, to go to barber school and learn to become a barber. Then he was injured so badly and, you know, it was really hard for him that he was going to get out of prison in a couple of years. But this person who lived in the community, he felt so badly for this inmate who had been beaten up so severely that he started a little fund to raise enough money so that the inmate could go to the barber school after he was released. So the community and different people collected money, and then they offered it to this inmate, who is now attending barber school. And he's almost done, he's learned how to do all these haircuts, I'll be stating, you know, everything you need to do. He's like full of self-confidence, and he's about ready to take his exams to become a licensed barber. And I thought, wow, here was a total stranger who read about somebody, an inmate of all people, you know, who was facing so much difficulty. And this guy had so much compassion, and he wanted to see the inmate have an education, so he had a vocation when he was released, and he raised that money. And I thought, wow, I mean, what a kind thing to do. So, you know, this kind of activity that we do when we get involved in making the world a better place, and we all have different talents to offer to the world. So we offer our different talents, but whatever we do, we create benefit now, and, you know, we create so much good karma. And then when we die, we can look back on our life and feel good about our life instead of having regrets. And then in this case, you know, the karma from generosity, this guy, you know, will have wealth in future lives. Okay? So another way karma ripens is in terms of what happens to us. When people insult us, when people criticize us or talk badly about us behind our back, this is a result of our own destructive karma. When people praise us, it's also a result of our own constructive karma. Okay? When we get sick, it's a result of our own misdeeds. When we enjoy good health, it's a result of our own virtuous deeds. Okay, so the karma ripens also in terms of what we experience. And often what we experience is similar to the actions that we did or the experience we made somebody else have. Then this second way of karma ripening, you know, is called the result that is concordant with the cause. So this first one is the result that's concordant with the cause in terms of our experience. So what we did towards others, we experienced something similar ourselves. Another branch of this one, of the result concordant with the cause, is the result concordant with the cause in terms of our habitual behavior. So we can see that we have habits, and that even many children are born with certain tendencies to do certain actions again and again. Yeah. And this can be, it's partially a result of what we're thinking about now, what mental factors arise in our mind, but it's also a result of the habitual actions and that we did in previous lives. Okay? So some people have the tendency to lie. Ever since they were little, they lied a lot. That's the result concordant with the cause in terms of habitual behavior. You can see it even when they're little kids. Yeah? Some little kids very naturally are kind to others, even kind to animals, yeah, without the parents teaching them. This is the result concordant with the cause in terms of habitual behavior. This particular result is one that we have to be very careful of, because our habitual actions are ones that accumulate a lot of karma over time. Now, so if we have the, you know, the ripening, let's say, of you know, some destructive karma, so that we have the tendency now to quarrel with a lot of people. If we don't learn the Dharma and learn how to control our temper, and instead we just have this tendency to quarrel, not only are we going to be miserable in this life, but we're putting more and more seeds of suffering in our own monastery. If we do actions repeatedly in this life, for example, being kind and considerate, being truthful, encouraging other people to do virtue, then we'll have that habitual tendency in a future life. And that's a habitual tendency that will serve us well, because it will help us create a lot of virtuous karma in future lives. Okay? So those are the two branches of the result that's concordant. Then the third result is the environmental result. Yeah? What environment we're born into and what experiences we have in that environment. So some people are born into an environment where there's lots of crops, a very good climate, you know, where the medicine is very potent. So they can live a happy life. Other people are born into an environment maybe where there's a lot of earthquakes, or where there's cliffs, or where there's a lot of jagged rocks, or where the ground isn't very fertile. Okay? So all of these kinds of things, why are we born in a certain environment? This is also influenced by our karma. Yeah. And you'll see some people, they live in a horrible environment, but somehow they can't leave it. Yeah. They won't move, or they want to move, but they can't get out. Yeah. That's because of some heavy karma. So, you know, when we look at karma, you know, a good way to understand it is there's two ways. One is to look at our actions now and think, what kind of rebirth will my actions cause? What kind of experiences will this action cause when I'm born human? In terms of what I will experience. What kind of experience will I have when I'm born human in terms of my habitual actions from the action I'm doing now? What kind of environment am I likely to be born in? Okay. So thinking, starting with the actions we're doing now and thinking of the different results we could have in the future. That's one way to meditate on karma. Another way is to think of what our present situation, and to think of what kind of causes we must have created in the past to have our present situation. So we're all born humans. It means we kept some degree of ethical conduct in the past. Maybe we took precepts and kept them very well. That's why we're human beings. You have what you need to stay alive. That's a result of generosity. Maybe you have some family problems. The family doesn't get along. That's the result of non-virtuous actions we created in the past. Okay? So it's very interesting to look at our present situation, or to look at the situation of the people around us, and think, oh, this is the kind of karma we must have created in the past that has brought about our present circumstance. Okay? So this way of thinking is very, very helpful in terms of understanding the law of karma and its effects. And it also, because we're applying it in a very practical manner to our own life, to the lives of the people we see around us, then it also motivates us. This way of contemplating motivates us to be mindful of our behavior, to have introspective awareness, you know, so that our afflictions don't make us create destructive karma, but instead to monitor our minds so that we have virtuous intentions that help us create constructive karma. Okay. So that's a lot of information. If we had another week or two, we could go into more of the details about karma. But we don't have that time. So I'll give you some books too that can help you. There's one book called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. Actually, I'm writing a commentary about it, which will be out in August. So next year when I'm here. Yeah, but it talks a lot about karma. Right now you might be able to get just the short version of it. It's not my book, but it's somebody else's commentary, one of my teacher's commentary. It's called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. Okay. If you look in some of the Lonergan books, the books on the stages of the path to awakening, in the chapter on karma, it goes into the results of karma, you know, in more detail. And this can be very, very helpful. Also, if you go to my website, tukenchojong.org, we have a lot of oral teachings and videos and transcripts. And so some of those have been about karma, going into more detail, so you can refer to that, because we can't do everything. But it's really helpful to contemplate these things, because it makes us wake up in our life and not take things for granted. And it motivates us to, you know, to have a virtuous mental state and to be helpful to others. Okay. So, I talked all morning. So we'll break now for lunch. Yeah, we'll do the lunch offering. And then when we come back, we'll have some questions from my ever-growing pile of questions. And then we'll have some discussion. And then to conclude for the people who want, then we'll take refuge and the precepts. I should mention the advantage to taking the precepts. You know, there's a big karmic advantage to taking precepts. Because when you have a precept, that determination not to do that certain non-virtuous action remains in your mind, even when you're sleeping, even when you're doing other things. Yeah. So every moment you're not breaking a precept, you're accumulating good karma by keeping that precept. So, for example, yeah, we're all sitting here in the room right now. Maybe there's one person who's taken the precept not to kill, and another person who hasn't taken that precept. Both of them are not killing at this moment, I hope. But the person who isn't killing, who has that precept, they're sitting here listening to the Dharma talk. They're actively accumulating virtuous karma by keeping that precept of not killing. The person who doesn't have that precept, who's also sitting here and they're not killing right now, they're not getting that constant accumulation of virtuous karma because there's no intention, there's no precept in their mind stream. Okay? So if we take the precepts and keep them well, it really builds up a lot of merit in our mind stream. And the precepts also act as a way for us to make good decisions. So maybe our time is running and we have to stop now. But maybe I'll talk a little bit more.